This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome, deep divers. Okay, picture this. A man, just moments after being shot right in the chest, bullet still lodged deep inside him.
Oh.
He assesses his own wound, decides it's not serious enough to stop him, and then goes on to deliver a 90-minute speech before getting any medical help.
It sounds like something out of a movie, doesn't it?
Exactly. But that's not some fictional hero. That was Theodore Roosevelt. And that, well, that's just one of these incredible, almost unbelievable stories from the life of the 26th President of the United States. He was a figure of just immense energy, sharp intellect, and, as we're definitely going to discover, some really profound contradictions.
Yeah, contradiction's a good word for him.
Born in 1858, passed away in 1919, Roosevelt lived a life so packed with experiences, it honestly feels like several lifetimes crammed into one. So today, our mission is to take a real deep dive into all the diverse sources we've gathered. You know, biographical accounts, policy details, personal reflections, historical analysis, the whole lot. And we want to uncover the most fascinating insights into this, well, this American icon. This isn't just going to be a surface level glance. We're really going to unpack the pivotal moments, the key policies that shaped him, and crucially, fundamentally reshaped the nation he led. So get ready to really try and understand the man behind the legend.
And that's exactly what makes this particular deep dive so compelling. We're talking about a transformation that's almost mythological, isn't it? You go from this sickly, asthmatic kid to a revered war hero, a brilliant naturalist, to a commanding president, a prolific author, to a daring explorer. It's quite the arc.
It really is.
And our goal isn't just to list his accomplishments. It's to try and figure out why he did what he did and maybe why it mattered so much.
Yeah.
Making those connections, you know, between his early formative experiences and his later really impactful leadership.
Okay.
So as we journey through his personal tragedies, and there were some big ones, his meteoric political rise, his really transformative presidency, and his lasting and, let's be honest, often debated legacy, we're really hunting for those aha moments, those surprising connections that hopefully bring history to life for you, our curious listener.
Okay, let's really unpack this journey then, starting right at the beginning. Theodore Roosevelt, born in New York City, October 27, 1858. And surprisingly, he's the striking contrast to the robust, vigorous figure we all picture. He was a sickly child, plagued by these debilitating asthma attacks that were, well, terrifying for him, obviously, but also left his parents feeling pretty helpless. Doctors back then, they just didn't have a cure.
Yeah, it must have been terrifying for the whole family.
Yeah.
You know, seeing your child struggle to breathe like that.
Absolutely. Yet, despite these really severe physical limitations, young Theodore, or TD, as they called him, had this almost boundless energy and a mischievously inquisitive spirit. His lifelong fascination with zoology, for instance, it sparked when he was just 7, after seeing a dead seal at a local market. Simple encounter, but profound for him.
Right. Just seeing seal.
Yeah. He didn't just look at it. He was so captivated, he actually got the seal's head. And with his cousins, they started what they called the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History.
Wow.
By age 9, he's already writing down his observations meticulously in a paper he called The Natural History of Insects. This wasn't just, a kid's hobby, was it?
Absolutely not. No way. This is a deep, enduring passion. It really laid the groundwork for so much later on, that early sort of hands-on scientific curiosity. It wasn't just about collecting things.
Right.
It was about observing, classifying, trying to understand the natural world in detail. It shows this intense intellectual drive, this desire to impose order on chaos, which, if you think about it, is kind of a pattern you see throughout his life, right? Whether it's science or politics.
That's a fantastic point.
Right.
And his path to that famous physicality, the whole strenuous life idea, that also started quite early. In 1869, during a family trip hiking in the Alps, he makes this remarkable discovery. Physical exertion actually seemed to minimize his asthma symptoms, and it boosted his spirits significantly. This was like a light bulb moment.
Ah, so that was the trigger.
Yeah, it ignited this fierce dedication to exercise. He later talked about this incident during a camping trip where he was manhandled by older boys, felt humiliated. That became a pivotal moment.
Hmm.
He gets home, immediately finds a boxing coach, commits himself to this really rigorous training regimen. So this wasn't just about getting healthy, was it? This was a conscious, almost defiant choice to like forge himself into a stronger person.
Oh, definitely. It was way more than just health. It was about building character, that early determination, you know, to conquer his asthma, to deliberately build himself up physically.
Right.
It wasn't just a physical transformation.
Yeah.
It directly shaped his whole worldview, his future strenuous life philosophy. It instilled this core belief.
Mm-hmm.
You meet challenges head on with relentless effort. And that really became the bedrock of his public persona, didn't it? Setting the stage for all his later political and military ambitions, he literally decided to fight his own body.
It's incredible when you think about it that way. He was mainly homeschooled, which resulted in an uneven but remarkably strong education. He was great at geography, history, biology, French, German.
Right.
But he did struggle with math, Latin, Greek, the classics. He then entered Harvard in 1876, already, you know, a young man with this deep intellectual curiosity and this growing physical strength.
Quite the combination already.
During his time at Harvard, though, a really profound personal tragedy struck. His father, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., died suddenly in 1878. This loss just devastated him.
Hmm. A huge blow.
Huge. Despite this emotional blow, Roosevelt inherited a significant amount of money, $60,000 back then. Which, you know, for context, is like $1.66 million today.
Wow. Okay. So he was set for life, basically.
Yeah. Exactly. Enough money to live comfortably forever. Yet he chose this path of relentless public service. He didn't want a life of leisure. It also highlights his moral compass. Even then, he was a dedicated Sunday school teacher at Harvard.
Okay.
And when the Episcopal minister insisted he converts to Episcopalianism to keep teaching there, Roosevelt said no. Instead, he chose to teach a mission class in a poor part of Cambridge. Shows his commitment to service over, well, dogma.
That decision really speaks volumes, doesn't it? It underscores his independence, his moral priorities. He wasn't just comfortable with his privilege. He felt this profound responsibility to serve.
Yeah.
And rejecting a requirement that clashed with his conscience. Choosing instead to teach somewhere less prestigious but maybe more impactful. That tells you a lot about the man he was becoming. Principled, driven by a personal sense of duty, not just social expectations.
Absolutely. His academic life at Harvard continued to show that same mix of, you know, intellectual brilliance and very specific interests. He'd excelled in science, philosophy, rhetoric, still struggled with Latin and Greek.
Still the classics, huh?
Still the classics. But he was an incredibly accomplished naturalist, even published as an ornithologist. And he had this almost photographic memory, apparently, which let him just devour books.
Amazing.
He graduated Phi Beta Kappa, ranked 22nd out of 177 magna cum laude. Pretty impressive. Yet, surprisingly, he felt he obtained little from Harvard, expressed disappointment with the formalistic treatment of many subjects. Too much focus on tiny details, maybe not enough on the big picture.
Interesting. So even then, he was looking for something more practical, more connected to the real world.
Seems like it. After Harvard, he initially thought about studying natural science, but then changed course, went to Columbia Law School.
Okay, law school. Seems more conventional.
Right. But he quickly found the study of law irrational, not grounded enough in tangible results for him, I guess. So he dropped out.
Dropped out.
Yeah. Which was an incredibly unorthodox move for someone of his social class back then. Most of his peers avoided politics, saw it as kind of a dirty business. But Roosevelt was determined to jump in.
Right into the fray.
He found allies in New York's 21st District Republican Association, got elected to the New York State Assembly, and he made an immediate impact. Blocked the financier Jay Gould's corrupt attempt to lower his taxes, exposed collusion. His anti-corruption stuff was so popular, he won re-election by more than 2-1.
So he hit the ground running. No fear.
None at all. And it wasn't just current politics that grabbed him. While he was still at Harvard, Roosevelt started this really systematic, extensive study of the U.S. Navy's role in the War of 1812.
Okay, naval history now. He had broad interests.
Very broad. This scholarly work led to his 1882 publication, The Naval War of 1812, a book that was widely praised for its scholarship, its style, and remarkably, it's still considered a standard study of the war today.
That's genuinely remarkable. He's already thinking strategically about naval power and not just historically. How much do you think that early systematic interest, maybe even before Mahon's famous work on sea power came out, how much did that shape his later actions, you know, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, as President?
It had to be significant.
It speaks to a very long-term, almost visionary strategic mind, doesn't it? Thinking decades ahead, really.
Absolutely. It wasn't just a historical interest. It feels like it was a foundational piece of his whole view on geopolitics, which definitely came out later. Now we get to one of the most poignant, just devastating periods of his life.
Okay.
In 1880, Roosevelt married Alice Hathaway Lee, a socialite. Their daughter, Alice Lee Roosevelt, was born February 12, 1884. Just 2 days later, February 14th, Valentine's Day, a date he'd forever mark with a big X in his diary.
Oh, no.
Tragedy struck twice, brutally. His wife, Alice, died of undiagnosed kidney failure. And on the very same day, his mother, Martha, died of typhoid fever.
On the same day. Both his wife and mother.
On the exact same day, it's almost unimaginable. The double loss was just crushing. In his diary, he just wrote, "The light has gone out of my life." The grief was so intense, he rarely spoke of his first wife, Alice, again. And he conspicuously left her out of his autobiography. That tells you something.
Wow. Just unbearable grief.
Totally. Distraught, needing some kind of outlet, he left baby Alice with his sister and sought this really radical form of recuperation.
What did he do?
He went west. Headed straight for the untamed wilderness of the Dakota Territory, invested $14,000, which is like $390,000 today, in a cattle ranch.
Complete change of scene.
Complete change. The raw, challenging Western lifestyle turned out to be exhilarating for him. He learned to ride Western style, rope, hunt, fully embraced the whole rancher persona. He even wrote books like Hunting Trips of a Ranchman and Ranch Life and The Hunting Trail. And in them, he really praised the stern, manly qualities of cowboys. Seems like a clear reflection of his own need for resilience, for strength after that terrible loss.
It's almost like he was consciously trying to forge a new version of himself through, you know, sheer physical effort and facing these harsh realities out there. How much do you think that period, that raw frontier living, shaped by such intense personal loss, really molded his character and truly imbued him with that strenuous life philosophy that became so central later? It wasn't just an escape, was it?
No, not at all. I think you're right. It was where he really honed those ideas about manliness, resilience, the value of facing harsh realities head on. This was the crucible that forged the strength, the moral vigor he'd show throughout his public life.
Makes sense.
And it wasn't just personal development either. Beyond his own pursuits, he quickly got involved in the early conservation movement and frontier law enforcement. He organized local ranchers into the Little Missouri Stockmen's Association to deal with issues like overgrazing.
Ah, early conservationist stirrings.
Definitely. He also formed the Boone and Crockett Club, dedicated to conserving large game animals and their habitats, a clear sign of his later environmental policies. And, you know, testament to his man of action thing, he even served as a deputy sheriff in Billings County, North Dakota, famously hunted down some boat thieves.
Wow, a deputy sheriff, too. He really threw himself into it.
He did. But the harsh realities of the West eventually caught up. The severe winter of 1886-1887 wiped out a huge chunk of his cattle herd. He lost over half of his $80,000 investment.
Ouch, that's a big loss.
Big loss. With his ranching dreams kind of dashed, he returned to New York. Shedding that potentially damaging label of being an ineffectual intellectual and ready to get back into politics.
So the West forged him, but ultimately sent him back east.
Pretty much. Back in York, a new chapter of his personal life started. In London, in 1886, he married his childhood friend, Edith Kermit Caro. Despite some initial family resistance, you know, because of timing after his first wife's death.
Right, that must have been delicate.
Yeah. Together, they had five children. And Edith also raised his daughter from his first marriage, Alice, who, it has to be said, often clashed with her stepmother, made for a rather complex family dynamic, apparently.
Blended families are never simple.
True. Upon his return, Republican leaders approached him about running for mayor of New York City in 1886. Roosevelt accepted, even though he didn't have much hope of winning against some tough opponents.
Okay, back into the political ring.
Campaigned hard, but finished third with 27% of the vote. Fearing his political career might be over, he once again turned to writing.
Ah, the writing fallback again.
Yep. Penned The Winning of the West, this big four-volume narrative exploring the American character forged on the frontier. It turned out to be a huge success. Got great reviews, sold out its first printing.
You know, this really highlights that recurring theme in his life, doesn't it? When politics goes sour or he faces personal setbacks, he often turns to writing.
It's true.
And it's not just a hobby, right? It's a way to solidify his intellectual side, his historical credentials, process things, articulate his philosophies. His books became a really significant part of his public identity, often laying the groundwork for his future political ideas. He was building his intellectual foundation even when his political career seemed, well, stalled.
Theodore Roosevelt's path towards the White House, it was absolutely marked by this relentless drive for reform,
yes.
Often putting him, you know, directly against the entrenched political machines of the time.
He wasn't afraid of a fight.
Not at all. After supporting Benjamin Harrison's successful 1888 campaign, Roosevelt got appointed to the United States Civil Service Commission in 1889.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
He served there until 1895. Now, unlike a lot of guys before him who saw the job as a sinecure, basically, you know, a cushy job with little work.
Right, just collect the paycheck.
Roosevelt immediately fought the spoilsmen, demanded strict enforcement of civil service laws, replacing political favors with merit-based hiring. The Sun newspaper called him irrepressible, belligerent, and enthusiastic.
Oh, that sounds about right.
He even famously clashed with the Postmaster General, John Wanamaker, over appointments. But President Harrison backed him up. His commitment was so clear that even the Democratic president, Grover Cleveland, reappointed him later.
That's a really crucial detail, actually, because it shows his unwavering commitment to merit over patronage. That became a defining characteristic for his whole career.
Yeah.
He was willing to cross party lines, even stand up to his own party for these principles. This early experience really cemented his reputation as this incorruptible reformer, someone who put good government above politics. It set a precedent for everything that came later. He was laying the groundwork for his square deal way before he called it that.
He absolutely was. His reformist energy then took him to New York City. In 1895, Mayor William Lafayette Strong appointed him president of the New York City Board of Police Commissioners.
Okay, tackling the NYPD, that's a big job.
Huge job. And he brought radical change, implemented regular firearms inspections, required physical exams for officers, pushed for merit-based recruitment, not political connections, established meritorious service medals, closed down corrupt police lodging houses, even had telephones installed in station houses, modernizing a system that desperately needed it.
Wow, he really shook things up.
He did. And during this time, in 1894, Roosevelt met Jacob Riis, who you could call one of the original muckraking journalists, a term, ironically, Roosevelt himself would later make famous.
Right, the irony.
Riis's powerful book, How the Other Half Lives, had exposed the terrible living conditions of New York's immigrants, especially in crime-ridden Mulberry Street. Riis famously said about Roosevelt, "No one ever helped as he did. For 2 years, we were brothers in Mulberry Street. For the first time, a moral purpose came into the street."
That's high praise.
It is. And Roosevelt wasn't just sitting in an office, right? He was out on the streets, often walking officers' beats late at night, early morning, making sure they were actually on duty, seeing the problems firsthand. This direct immersion in the city's underbelly profoundly shaped his understanding of urban poverty and the need for social reform.
It's an incredible image, isn't it? A man like Roosevelt, from his background, walking police beats at night, engaging directly with the struggles of the poor.
Yeah.
It really highlights his fundamental belief in direct action and experiential learning. He didn't just read reports about problems. He wanted to live them, understand them from the ground up. That hands-on approach to reform, it defined his leadership for years.
It really cemented that man of action image. Roosevelt's national profile kept rising, which led to his appointment as Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1897 by President McKinley.
Okay, moving up to the federal level.
Yep. With Secretary Long often in poor health, Roosevelt gained significant influence. Deeply influenced by naval theorist Alfred Thayer Mahan, he became this vocal advocate for a big naval buildup, especially battleships, and he was adamant that Spain had to get out of Cuba.
Already pushing for a strong foreign policy.
Very much so. His foreign policy views back then were quite provocative. He openly talked about his priorities, interfering for the Cubans on grounds of humanity and self-interest, freeing America from European dominance, and critically, the benefit done our military forces by trying both the Navy and Army in actual practice.
Wow, trying them in actual practice. He saw war as almost necessary training.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? He saw a direct link between national strength and military experience, and this philosophy soon got put to the test. February 15, 1898, the USS Maine explodes in Havana Harbor.
The flashpoint.
Exactly. While McKinley was trying for a diplomatic solution, Roosevelt famously, and without approval from his boss or the president, unilaterally sent orders to several naval vessels to prepare for war.
He just did it.
Just did it. George Dewey, who Roosevelt had helped get appointed to lead the Asiatic Squadron, later credited Roosevelt's unauthorized orders for his huge victory at Manila Bay.
Yeah.
Eventually, McKinley declared war. The Spanish-American War began.
So Roosevelt kind of forced the issue, in a way.
You could argue that. With the war starting, Roosevelt promptly resigned from the Navy Department, much to the dismay of his wife and friends, to form the 1st U.S. Volunteer Cavalry Regiment with Army Colonel Leonard Wood.
The Rough Riders.
The Rough Riders, yep. Nicknamed that by the press. This incredibly diverse unit was flooded with applications. Ivy Leaguers, athletes, frontiersmen, Native Americans, you name it, all eager to join their charismatic leader.
Quite the mix.
They landed in Daiquiri, Cuba, June 23, 1898. Roosevelt got his first taste of combat at the Battle of Las Guasimas. But most famously, July 1st, the Rough Riders became legendary for their charges up Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill.
The famous charge.
The famous charge. Roosevelt, apparently the only soldier on horseback, rode back and forth right at the front, urging the advance, even without direct orders. He later called it the great day of my life. This military experience just catapulted him to national hero status. I mean, being the only soldier on horseback charging up that hill. How much do you think that specific moment solidified his image and just propelled him forward politically?
Oh, hugely. Immensely. That San Juan Hill charge became the absolute cornerstone of his public image. It solidified this warrior persona in his own mind, and definitely in the public's mind.
Yeah.
He even preferred being called Colonel Roosevelt after he came back to civilian life. It ingrained this whole idea of decisive, direct action, physical courage, which served him incredibly well politically, didn't it? It became a defining characteristic people expected from him.
So that heroic return meant he was practically unstoppable in New York politics, right?
Pretty much.
He was quickly approached by the Republican Party boss, Thomas C. Platt, about running for governor of New York in 1898. Now, Platt personally didn't like Roosevelt's ambitious reform agenda.
I bet he didn't.
But he knew he needed a strong candidate. And Roosevelt's war record made him unbeatable. He campaigned hard, won the governorship, though by a pretty narrow 1% margin.
Still a win's a win.
As governor, Roosevelt really started to develop what would become his square deal principles. He dove into complex economic issues, tackling trusts, labor relations, conservation. His program, he said, rested firmly upon the concept of the square deal by a neutral state, emphasizing honesty, equitable sharing, putting state interests above party concerns.
So the ideas were forming.
They were. He pioneered political innovations, too. Held twice daily press conferences to connect directly with his middle-class base. Successfully pushed the Ford franchise tax bill, which taxed public franchises held by corporations.
Taking on corporate power early.
Definitely. He often clashed with Platt, who expected to be consulted on big appointments. Roosevelt kind of played along, appeared to comply, but ultimately made his own decisions. Often appointed really first-rate people, even if Platt also approved them. His governorship was a real proving ground, wasn't it, for so many of the principles that would define his presidency?
Absolutely.
You know, public responsibility of big corporations, transparency for trusts, railroad rate regulation, mediating capital labor fights, conservation, protecting the poor.
It really was. His governorship served as this vital testing ground for many of the progressive policies he'd later champion as president. It gave him a practical framework for his evolving approach to balancing powerful business interests with public welfare. You see it directly taking shape with those square deal ideas. That period was crucial for him to articulate and refine his vision. He basically ran a miniature progressive agenda in New York first.
That's a perfect way to put it. Now, here's where his political path takes this incredibly unexpected turn. November 1899, Vice President Garrett Hobart dies, leaves an open spot on the 1900 Republican ticket.
An opening.
Thomas Platt and other party bosses, who were frankly eager to get Roosevelt's reformist agenda out of New York.
Right, kick him upstairs.
Exactly. They saw their chance. They pushed him into the vice presidency, which back then was seen as a pretty powerless position. Roosevelt initially said he would not accept the nomination, wanted to stay in New York, keep pushing reforms, but he got outmaneuvered at the 1900 Republican National Convention and, well, ultimately accepted.
So they sidelined him, or thought they did?
They thought they did. He threw himself into the campaign for the McKinley-Roosevelt ticket with his usual energy, made 480 stops in 23 states, used his war heroism to contrast what he called William Jennings Bryan's radicalism.
Played the hero card.
Big time. But once in office, he found the VP job to be a powerless sinecure, uneventful and boring for a guy like him. It was during this time, actually, September 2, 1901, that he first publicly used that famous line, "Speak softly and carry a big stick and you will go far."
The origin of the phrase, "Well, word is VP."
Exactly. And here's where fate just steps in dramatically. This office, which he found so dull, so constraining, suddenly put him right on the edge of the most powerful job in the world.
Yeah.
September 6, 1901, President McKinley is shot by an anarchist. Roosevelt, who was vacationing in Vermont, rushes to Buffalo. McKinley initially seems to recover, so Roosevelt, maybe a bit too optimistically, resumes his vacation.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But McKinley's condition worsened dramatically. Roosevelt rushed back, learned McKinley had died on September 14th. That same day, at age 42, Theodore Roosevelt was sworn in as the 26th president, became, and still is, the youngest person ever to assume the office.
Wow, just like that. Youngest president ever.
Youngest ever. His ascension, well, it was met with mixed feelings. Conservative Republicans feared the impulsive young president would be a bucking bronco. Reformers hoped he'd refashion the Republican Party into the progressive force it had been under Abraham Lincoln.
High stakes, high expectations.
Totally. Roosevelt, for his part, made it clear. He aimed to push forward the reactionaries in Congress and appeal directly to the people. It was a truly pivotal moment in American history.
So, with the weight of the presidency suddenly on his shoulders, Theodore Roosevelt didn't waste any time putting his vision into action, did he? Especially through his square deal domestic policies.
No time at all. One of his first really bold moves shortly after taking office was inviting Booker T. Washington to dinner at the White House.
Which was huge back then.
Groundbreaking. And it sparked this bitter reaction across the segregated South. Roosevelt had initially planned more dinners like that, but he later avoided them to keep crucial political support in the White South. A pragmatic choice, maybe, amidst that intense backlash.
Yeah, tough calculation politically.
Roosevelt quickly became known as the Trust Buster for his aggressive, really unprecedented use of the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act. That was the law meant to curb monopolies that hurt trade and competition.
A big shift from previous presidents.
Huge shift. He had a nuanced view, though. He believed big business was essential, but he aggressively went after bad trusts, the ones that restrained trade, charged unfair prices, or generally acted against the public good.
So not anti-business per se, but anti-bad business.
Exactly. His administration brought 44 antitrust suits. Compare that to just 18 combined by the three presidents before him. He successfully broke up the Northern Securities Company, that massive railroad monopoly, and regulated Standard Oil, the dominant oil company.
Taking on giants.
To boost these efforts, even though Congress was skeptical about its antitrust powers, he created the Department of Commerce and Labor, which included the Bureau of Corporations. He skillfully appealed directly to the public to pressure Congress, got the bill passed, showed his mastery of public opinion. So, yeah, he wasn't just blindly attacking all corporations.
Not at all. And that's the really crucial nuance, isn't it? He wasn't anti-business. He was anti-bad business.
Yeah.
And that distinction, it allowed him to champion these aggressive progressive policies, which often challenged powerful corporate interests while still operating within the Republican Party, albeit with, you know, considerable internal fights.
Right.
He understood that a healthy economy needed big business, but it also needed oversight to stop abuses of power that hurt the average person. It showed a really pragmatic side to his progressivism.
That pragmatic streak, it also extended to labor relations.
Wow.
May 1902, there's this big anthracite coal strike. Threatened a national energy shortage. Could have crippled the country.
A major crisis.
Roosevelt steps in. Threatens the coal operators with federal troops if they refuse to negotiate. This was unprecedented presidential intervention.
Wow. Using the military threat.
Yeah. It led to arbitration. Miners got more pay, fewer hours, though they didn't get union recognition. But this marked a historic moment. Roosevelt became the first president to successfully help settle a labor dispute. Famously declared, "My action on labor should always be considered in connection with my action as regards capital, and both are reducible to my favorite formula, a square deal for every man."
A square deal for every man. There it is.
Beyond corporations and labor, Roosevelt swiftly tackled corruption within his own government, rooted out misconduct in the Indian Service, the General Land Office, the Post Office Department.
Cleaning house.
Prosecuted corrupt Indian agents who cheated tribes out of land, forced out officials involved in land fraud. His special prosecutor about 146 indictments in the Oregon Land Office bribery ring, 44 postal employees prosecuted for bribery and fraud, underscored his commitment to clean government.
He wasn't messing around.
He also tackled railroad rates. Merchants had long complained they were way too high. Working with a Democrat, Senator Benjamin Tillman, Roosevelt pushed for the Hepburn Act in 1906. This significantly empowered the Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC.
Gave it teeth.
Exactly. Gave the ICC power to set just and reasonable maximum rates. Extended its regulatory power over pipelines, storage contracts. Fundamentally changed how those industries were overseen.
Big regulatory expansion.
One of his most lasting achievements in consumer protection came directly from public outrage, especially after Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle.
Ah, yes, The Jungle. Horrifying stuff.
Detailed those unsanitary, dangerous practices in meatpacking. Roosevelt responded, pushed Congress to pass two landmark laws in 1906.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Inspection Act banned misleading labels, harmful preservatives, and the Pure Food and Drug Act banned impure or falsely labeled food and drugs.
Foundational consumer protection laws we still benefit from.
Absolutely. And showing a broader commitment to public welfare, he also convened the first White House conference on the care of dependent children in 1909.
So a wide range of domestic reforms.
But of all his accomplishments, Roosevelt himself was proudest of his work in conserving natural resources and extending federal protection to land and wildlife.
Yes, the conservation legacy is huge.
He partnered closely with Interior Secretary James Rudolph Garfield and the Chief of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot. Enacted this sweeping series of conservation programs, often facing resistance from Western members of Congress.
Who saw it as federal overreach, probably.
Exactly. Under him, the U.S. Forest Service was established, 5 new national parks created. He signed the 1906 Antiquities Act, used it to proclaim 18 new U.S. national monuments, established the first 51 bird reserves, 4 game preserves, 150 national forests, ultimately placed about 230 million acres under public protection. It's a staggering amount, isn't it?
It really is staggering, and it highlights his extensive, often aggressive use of executive orders, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He reserves 150 million acres of forestry land during his presidency and was completely unapologetic about it, despite all that congressional resistance. There's that memorable story, right? When Senator Fulton tried to stop him from reserving more land with an amendment, Roosevelt established an additional 21 forest reserves at the very last minute, just before signing the bill. What does that tell us about his views on presidential power and his just unyielding dedication to conservation?
It tells us he saw it as a moral duty, absolutely, and he was willing to use every single tool he had, even outmaneuvering Congress, to get his conservation goals met. Now, beyond domestic reforms, Roosevelt's presidency really marked America's emergence as a major player on the world stage.
Right, shifting to foreign policy.
After the Spanish-American War successes, getting a new empire, having the world's largest economy, Roosevelt actively sought global recognition and influence for the U.S.
Stepping onto the world stage.
He cultivated friendly relations with Japan, even though he secretly favored them in the Russo-Japanese War. He successfully mediated the end of that war at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a huge effort that earned him the 1906 Nobel Peace Prize, the first American to win any Nobel Prize.
Nobel Peace Prize winner. Quite something for the big stick guy.
It is. Amidst growing anti-Japanese hostility in California, he negotiated the Gentlemen's Agreement in 1907, ended explicit discrimination there in exchange for Japan agreeing to limit unskilled immigration.
A diplomatic solution to a domestic problem.
And he projected American naval power by sending the Great White Fleet on a world tour in 1908. Despite its, intimidating presence, the fleet got a joyous welcome in Japan. Help facilitate the Root-Takahira Agreement, reaffirming the status quo in Korea and the Philippines.
So, projecting power, but also diplomacy.
His global vision also reached China. After the Boxer Rebellion, foreign powers imposed these indemnities. In 1908, Roosevelt used these funds for Boxer indemnity scholarships, funding tens of thousands of Chinese students to study in the U.S. over the next 40 years, fostering goodwill, cultural exchange.
That's a really interesting long-term investment in relations.
In Europe, Roosevelt acted as a key diplomat, a friend, mediated the first Moroccan crisis, successfully averted a potential war between France and Germany.
Playing peacemaker again.
Significantly strengthened ties with Great Britain, the Great Rapprochement period, helped by British support during the Spanish-American War and their withdrawal from the Caribbean. The 1901 Hay-Pontsvot Treaty, which got rid of previous canal limitations, and the favorable settlement of the Alaska boundary dispute, which Roosevelt called the last serious trouble between them, further cemented this alliance.
Building key alliances.
However, Roosevelt's most ambitious overseas project, and where he really directed America's ambitions, was Latin America, especially for the defense and construction of the Panama Canal.
Ah, the canal. Big project.
Huge. He dramatically increased the Navy's size. By the end of his second term, the U.S. had more battleships than any country except Britain.
Building that big stick.
In 1902, the Venezuelan crisis, Germany, Britain, Italy blockaded Venezuelan ports over unpaid loans. Roosevelt deftly defused it, got them to agree to arbitration. He was particularly worried about German motives.
Keeping Europe out of the hemisphere.
Exactly. This concern ultimately led him to issue the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine in 1904. This basically stated that chronic wrongdoing by Latin American nations might require intervention by some civilized nation, and the U.S. would exercise an international police power in the Western Hemisphere to prevent European interference.
The U.S. as regional policeman, a controversial doctrine.
Very controversial. The Panama Canal was his crowning achievement in the region, though. Roosevelt persuaded Congress to approve the Panamanian route. When Colombia rejected the treaty, Roosevelt supported a Panamanian rebellion. It succeeded quickly, letting him sign a treaty with the new Panama government in 1903.
Supporting rebellion. Also controversial.
Highly criticized. Especially for the $40 million payment to the Panama Canal Company, allegations of undue influence in choosing the route. Roosevelt vehemently denied corruption, even filed libel charges against newspapers, the Roosevelt-Panama libel cases, though they were dismissed. In 1906, he again showed his interventionist stance, sending Secretary of War Taft to monitor an insurrection in Cuba, believing he could deploy Marines without Congress's okay. This was a very active, very decisive approach to foreign policy, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Roosevelt's foreign policy, it was deeply rooted in this realist, even social Darwinist perspective. He really viewed the international world as a realm of violence and conflict.
Right.
He genuinely saw the U.S. as having a duty to act decisively as the policeman of the region to prevent European incursions. That idea was rooted in his belief in national strength, strategic necessity. For him, power imbalances required decisive action, and he wasn't afraid to wield that big stick.
He certainly wasn't. Roosevelt was also a master of media, truly transformed the White House into a center of news, gave reporters unprecedented access, interviews, photo ops.
The first modern media president, in a way.
You could say that. Famously noticed reporters huddled outside in the rain one day and, brilliant move, gave them their own room inside, effectively inventing the presidential press briefing.
Smart move.
This grateful press, with their better access, rewarded him with tons of coverage. While he generally had close relationships with the press, he did coin the term muckraker in 1906 for those expose journalists, though he himself was rarely their direct target.
Interesting dynamic with the press.
As the 1904 election neared, Roosevelt faced little real opposition for the Republican nomination, secured it easily with Charles Warren Fairbanks as his VP. Now, incumbents traditionally didn't campaign actively.
Right, seen as unseemly.
But Roosevelt broke with tradition. Meticulously controlled the campaign's message, despite accusations of corporate campaign contributions, especially from Standard Oil, which he denied, though he did order some returns. Roosevelt's promise of a square deal resonated, won a landslide, 56% popular vote, 336 electoral votes.
Huge mandate.
Huge. However, before his inauguration, he declared he would not serve another term, a pledge that would significantly impact his power as a lame duck president later on.
Ah, the lame duck pledge. That would come back to bite him.
It did. As his second term went on, that pledge meant his influence in Congress naturally started to wane, especially as he moved to the left of his Republican Party base.
Pushing for more reforms.
Yeah. He started calling for a whole series of reforms that Congress often just failed to pass. A national incorporation law, a federal income tax despite previous Supreme Court rulings against it, an inheritance tax, limits on court injunctions against unions, an employee liability law for industrial injuries, an 8-hour workday for federal employees, a postal savings system, campaign finance reform.
Wow, a very progressive agenda for the time. And Congress wasn't buying it.
Not much of it. His rhetoric during this period got really intense, very moralistic, like his denunciation of predatory wealth in a 1908 message to Congress.
What did he mean by that?
He defined it as the wealth accumulated on a giant scale by all forms of iniquity. Accused some wealthy men of banding together to discredit government policy, maintain freedom from all restraint. He believed their actions taught young men that success could be built on dishonesty, equated their methods with every form of criminality on the part of a labor union, and every form of violence, corruption, and fraud. Powerful stuff, especially for a Republican president back then.
It really was powerful stuff. And what's fascinating here is that tension, isn't it? Between his powerful, almost moralistic rhetoric and the political realities of being a lame duck president.
Yeah.
While his influence might have weakened in Congress, this period was crucial for solidifying his progressive ideals. It allowed him to articulate this more radical vision for government intervention. It really set the stage for future ideological battles within the Republican Party, showing his evolving commitment to social justice even when the political winds were against him. He wasn't just reacting, he was setting a future agenda.
So, as his second term drew to a close, Theodore Roosevelt decided to honor that pledge not to run again. He genuinely believed limited terms were vital to prevent dictatorship.
A principled stand, given his popularity.
It was. He carefully chose Secretary of War William Howard Taft as his successor. Taft had consistently supported his policies, been a close friend since 1890. Roosevelt was so determined to install his chosen successor, he famously wrote to Taft, "Dear Will, do you want any action about those federal officials? I will break their necks with the utmost cheerfulness if you say the word."
Wow. Break their necks. That's some strong support.
Intense support. It ensured Taft's nomination and his win in the 1908 election. However, Taft's presidency quickly turned out differently than Roosevelt had envisioned.
How so?
Taft, who was a constitutional lawyer at heart, preferred promoting progressivism through the rule of law, through judges. A real contrast to Roosevelt's more political, direct action approach. Taft's handling of the Payne-Aldrich tariff in 1909 and his conservation policies alienated a lot of progressives, including Roosevelt himself.
Ah, the tariff and conservation again. Key issues for TR.
Exactly. Roosevelt felt Taft was concentrating power with conservative party leaders. This growing frustration marked the beginning of a really significant ideological split between the two former friends.
The beginning of the end for their friendship.
After leaving office, Roosevelt didn't exactly retire quietly. He embarked on these incredibly ambitious adventures. March 1909, he leads the Smithsonian Roosevelt African Expedition.
The famous safari.
Yep. a well-financed year-long safari through East Africa, the Belgian Congo, collecting an extraordinary number of specimens for the Smithsonian and the American Museum of Natural History. The team killed or trapped something like 11,400 animals, including 512 big game animals.
That number sounds shocking today.
It does. Roosevelt defended it, arguing it was purely for scientific collection, comparing it to how natural history museums acquire specimens. He meticulously documented the whole trip in his book, African Game Trails.
Still the naturalist, even while hunting on that scale.
Following the safari, Roosevelt traveled to Europe in 1910, embarked on this big diplomatic tour, met with various European leaders, Kaiser Wilhelm II, King George V.
Rubbing shoulders with royalty.
In Oslo, he delivered a speech calling for limits on naval armaments, strengthening the permanent court of arbitration, and, interestingly, advocating for the creation of a League of Peace among world powers.
A League of Peace? That sounds very familiar. Like Wilson's idea later.
It does sound similar. At Oxford, he gave the Romanes lecture, where he denounced people trying to draw parallels between animal evolution and societal development, showed his commitment to scientific accuracy, his evolving social views. But that League of Peace idea, it sounds like Wilson, but there's a key difference, isn't there?
There's a huge difference, and that's where it gets really, really interesting. Roosevelt's League of Peace proposal, years before Wilson's League of Nations, it wasn't just about moral pressure or international law.
Right.
His vision explicitly included the idea of great powers using force, if necessary, to maintain peace. This was a significant departure from the more legalistic, idealistic approach Wilson would later champion. It reflects Roosevelt's deeply ingrained realist foreign policy views. He believed in peace through strength, not just through agreements on paper.
That distinction is so important. Back home, Roosevelt's frustrations with Taft's presidency just kept mounting. Taft's policies on conservation, the tariff, his perceived lack of consultation. It all increasingly alienated Roosevelt. He eventually came to believe Taft was simply unfit for leadership.
Ouch. Strong words for a former protege.
The ideological gap between them got even wider over the role of the judiciary. Roosevelt severely criticized the nation's courts, attacked the Supreme Court's 1905 Lochner v. New York decision that struck down a state law limiting bakers' working hours, arguing it interfered with freedom of contract.
Right, controversial decision.
Roosevelt accused federal courts of undermining democracy, called for judicial recall, this radical idea that would let popular majorities reverse unpopular judicial decisions. This horrified Taft.
I can imagine. Taft was a judge himself.
Exactly. Taft, despite privately disagreeing with some court rulings, was an adamant believer in judicial authority being essential to constitutional government.
Two fundamentally different views on the courts.
Roosevelt's growing disillusionment finally boiled over in his August 1910 New Nationalism speech in Osawatomie, Kansas. This was arguably the most radical speech of his entire career, marked his public break with Taft and the conservative Republicans.
What did he say?
He advocated for the priority of labor over capital, strong government control of corporations, a ban on corporate political contributions, emphasized aggressive government intervention to protect the people from, as he saw it, selfish interests.
Wow, that is radical for the time, especially for a Republican.
The disagreement even extended to international relations. Taft believed in arbitration as the path to peace, pursued treaties with Britain and France to submit disputes to the Hague Court.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Okay, trying diplomacy.
But Roosevelt, working with his close friend, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, actively sabotaged those treaties with amendments. Roosevelt thought arbitration was foolhardy idealism, a naive solution for serious international conflicts. He preferred a realism of war as the ultimate decider of big issues. So the party was really being torn apart from the inside, wasn't it?
Absolutely. This highlights a truly significant ideological schism within the Republican Party and between these two men who were once so close. Roosevelt's new nationalism was indeed seen as radical back then, emphasizing aggressive government action to protect people from what he called selfish interests. This deep divide wasn't just personal, it foreshadowed a major political earthquake that was about to hit in the next election.
And the stage was definitely set for some unprecedented political drama in 1912. November 1911, Ohio Republicans endorse Roosevelt for the presidential nomination. January 1912, he famously declares, "If the people make a draft on me, I shall not decline to serve."
Throwing his hat back in the ring.
The 1912 election saw the first real widespread use of presidential primaries. Roosevelt did really well, won many states, but Taft, using the support of the party regulars, the establishment, secured the Republican nomination at the convention.
The party machine strikes back.
Roosevelt felt the nomination had been stolen from him. He famously declared to his cheering supporters, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord."
Dramatic language.
True to his word, he stormed out of the Republican Party, founded the Progressive Party, quickly nicknamed the Bull Moose Party.
The Bull Moose Party is born.
It attracted a diverse group of reformers. Prominent figures like social reformer Jane Addams campaigned for him. Gifford Pinchot represented the environmentalists. Their platform echoed his new nationalism, vigorous government intervention to destroy this invisible government, an unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics.
A clear anti-establishment message.
It is important to note, though, that in the South, Roosevelt ran a lily-white campaign, chose to seat all white delegations despite rival black delegations being present, reflects the pervasive racial politics of that era.
Yeah, a difficult aspect of his legacy there.
Then, October 14, 1912, while arriving for a campaign event in Milwaukee, the unthinkable happens. Roosevelt is shot by a delusional saloon keeper named John Schrenk.
Shot while campaigning.
Shot. The bullet lodged in his chest after going through his eyeglass case and a thick 50-page folded copy of his speech he had in his pocket.
The speech might have saved his life.
It very likely did. Now, here's the part that just perfectly showcases the strenuous life personified. As an experienced hunter and anatomist, Roosevelt correctly figured out that since he wasn't coughing blood, the bullet hadn't hit his lung. He then, incredibly, refused immediate hospital care and proceeded to deliver a 90-minute speech with blood visibly seeping into his shirt, simply told the shocked audience, "I'm fit as a bull moose."
He gave this speech after being shot for 90 minutes.
For 90 minutes. This audacious act not only gave the Progressive Party its lasting nickname, but just cemented his legend. Doctors later decided it was safer to leave the bullet in. He carried it for the rest of his life. Can you even imagine the sheer willpower to do something like that?
It's almost beyond belief, isn't it? Yeah. Perfectly encapsulates his entire philosophy. Face adversity head on with immense physical courage, mental fortitude. It wasn't just bravery. It was a political statement showing his unwavering commitment. It's one of those moments that feels more like myth than reality, but it was absolutely true to who he was.
Despite this incredible display of resilience, the Republican split between Roosevelt and Taft ultimately cleared the way for Democratic victory. Woodrow Wilson won the presidency, 42% popular vote, 435 electoral votes.
The split did him in.
Roosevelt got 27% of the popular vote, 4.1 million votes, won six states, the highest share for any third-party candidate in history, but yeah, not enough to overcome the fractured Republican vote.
Still an impressive showing for a third party.
After his defeat, Roosevelt's thirst for adventure was, well, unquenched. In 1913, he embarked on another perilous journey, the River of Doubt Expedition in South America.
He just couldn't sit still, could he?
Invited by John Augustin Zahm, financed by the American Museum of Natural History, he joined Brazilian explorer Candido Rondon to find the headwaters of the Duvida River, later renamed the Roosevelt River, and trace it through uncharted jungle.
Uncharted jungle. After everything else.
The expedition was brutal. Roosevelt suffered a minor leg wound that quickly got infected, developed into a tropical fever like the malaria he'd had in Cuba, severe chest pains, delirium. He lost 50 pounds.
Oh my goodness.
At one point, he was so ill, he insisted they leave him behind to die to save the expedition, even prepared to commit suicide with morphine he carried. Only his son Kermit's passionate plea persuaded him to keep going.
That's incredibly grim. saved by his son.
The journey, though successful in mapping the river, likely cut his life short by 10 years, plagued him with malaria flare-ups, severe leg inflammations for the rest of his life. Despite initial skepticism back home, he successfully defended his claims of exploring this uncharted 625-mile river to the National Geographic Society. This was an incredibly audacious, dangerous undertaking, even for a former president.
It really was. And it highlights the sheer audacity, the physical endurance of the man, even later in life. What does it say about his strenuous life philosophy that he'd undertake such a perilous journey almost to his own death after the presidency?
Yeah.
It reveals this deeply ingrained need for challenge, for testing his limits, for embracing a life of action and adventure, regardless of the personal cost. He simply couldn't sit still.
Upon his return to the U.S. in May 1914, the Progressive Party was already falling apart. Roosevelt eventually rejoined the Republicans, supported Charles Evans Hughes against Wilson in 1916. When World War I broke out in Europe in 1914, Roosevelt became a fierce critic of President Wilson's neutrality policy.
Back to criticizing Wilson.
Strongly supported the Allies, demanded a harsher stance against Germany, denounced Wilson's policy as an ignoble shirking of responsibility, a cowardly and dangerous neutrality.
Strong language again.
He also famously denounced Irish and German Americans as unpatriotic hyphenated Americans, insisted on 100% Americanism. In a powerful testament to his warrior spirit, Congress authorized him to raise volunteer divisions like his Rough Riders for service in France.
He wanted to lead troops again, at his age.
He did, but President Wilson rejected his offer to lead them, sent General John J. Pershing instead. Roosevelt never forgave Wilson for that snub, a personal wound that lingered. Tragically, in 1918, his youngest son, Quentin, a pilot with the American forces, was killed in France. Roosevelt never recovered from his loss.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Losing his son in the war he so strongly advocated for.
Devastating. Despite his failing health, Roosevelt maintained a clear vision for global order, building on his earlier ideas. In his 1910 Nobel address, he'd already proposed that League of Peace among great powers, one with executive power, use of force if needed.
The forceful league.
By 1914, he elaborated, suggested a world league for the peace of righteousness. It would preserve sovereignty, limit arms, require arbitration, but with nations guaranteeing military force against any who refused to comply. This sounds a lot like Wilson's proposal, but again, with that critical difference in enforcement, right?
Exactly. It's fascinating how he envisioned this very different kind of global order than Wilson's later League of Nations. Roosevelt's version prioritized force, enforcement, as absolutely essential to peace, reflecting his realist views.
Yeah.
He believed international commitments were only as strong as the willingness of powerful nations to back them with military might, whereas Wilson placed more faith in collective security, moral persuasion. Two very different approaches to peace.
In his final political activities, Roosevelt criticized Wilson's 14 points. Advocated instead for unconditional German surrender. Despite his uncertain health, he was widely seen as a leading contender for the 1920 Republican nomination.
Planning another run, even after everything.
It seemed like it. He advocated what he called sane constructive radicalism, a platform including old age pensions, unemployment insurance, public housing, reduced working hours, aid to farmers, more corporate regulation, showcased his continued progressive leanings.
Still pushing progressive ideas.
However, his health, severely damaged by those jungle diseases from the Amazon trip, deteriorated throughout 1918. He was hospitalized for 7 weeks, never fully recovered. On the night of January 5, 1919, he suffered breathing problems. After treatment, felt better, went to bed. Between 4.0 and 4.15 the next morning, Theodore Roosevelt died in his sleep at Sagamore Hill, age 60, of a pulmonary embolism.
So young, really, 60, after living such a full life.
Upon hearing the news, his son Archibald famously telegraphed his siblings, "The old lion is dead." And Vice President Thomas R. Marshall offered this profound tribute, perfectly capturing Roosevelt's spirit. Death had to take Roosevelt sleeping, for if he had been awake, there would have been a fight.
What a line. Sums him up perfectly.
He was buried on a hillside overlooking Oyster Bay, a quiet end for a man whose life was anything but quiet.
Theodore Roosevelt's legacy, it stretches so far beyond just his presidency, doesn't it? It's deeply woven into American culture through his prolific writing, his larger-than-life persona, and the countless ways he's been remembered.
Absolutely. He was, first and foremost, a prolific author and intellectual. wrote with real passion on an astonishing range of subjects.
You really did.
In all, Roosevelt penned about 18 books, including his powerful autobiography, The Rough Riders, That Systematic History of the Naval War of 1812, and other works on ranching, explorations, wildlife.
A huge output.
His most ambitious literary project was the four-volume narrative, The Winning of the West. In it, he argued for the emergence of this new American race, forged from heroic wilderness hunters and Indian fighters on the frontier, shaping a particular narrative of American identity.
Hmm. A narrative that's been debated since, of course.
Of course. He also got involved in this widely publicized literary debate, the Nature Fakers controversy in 1905. He criticized popular writers of the time, like Ernest Thompson Seton and William J. Long, for what he called their fantastical representations of wildlife and excessive anthropomorphism.
Ah, the nature fakers.
It was President Roosevelt himself who popularized that negative term, nature faker, for writers who gave exaggerated human traits to animals. He advocated instead for scientific accuracy in natural history. Why was that specific fight so important to him, do you think?
Well, I think it's because it really shows his deep commitment to scientific accuracy, even as this hugely popular public figure.
Yep.
It highlights his naturalist background, his intellectual rigor. It shows his love for the outdoors wasn't just, you know, romanticism. It was grounded in a careful, observant, truthful understanding of the natural world. He truly believed in truth and precision, whether it was in politics, history, or studying animals, and he just didn't tolerate what he saw as sentimental dishonesty.
Makes sense. Roosevelt's character, his beliefs, especially his philosophy of the strenuous life, they're central to understanding him. He kept up this lifelong interest in physical activity, regularly engaged in boxing, tennis, hiking, rowing, polo, horseback riding.
The list goes on.
As president, he even kept boxing until he was blinded in one eye, a fact he kept secret for many years. He also pushed for jiu-jitsu training for American soldiers, worried about military readiness.
Always focused on strength and readiness.
Historians often emphasize his warrior persona, argue his warrior spirit framed his views of national politics and international relations. Critics like Howard K. Beale argue he romanticized war, gloried in war, saw peace as dull and effeminate.
The critique that he loved war too much.
Yet, Roosevelt himself boasted in his autobiography that during his 7.5 years as president, not one shot had been fired against a foreign foe. Shows a nuanced understanding of his own impact, perhaps.
Or at least how he wanted it perceived. It's complex.
Despite his often secular-sounding, strenuous life talk, Roosevelt was a lifelong member of the Dutch Reformed Church, actively encouraged church attendance.
Interesting. The religious dimension is sometimes overlooked.
He believed Bible teachings were interwoven and entwined with our whole civic and social life, saw them as essential for public and private morals, asserted that removing these teachings would strip away almost all the standards society judges itself by.
So a strong moral underpinning to his worldview.
His economic views also evolved quite significantly. While he started his presidency with a cautious approach to business, he became increasingly distrustful of big business later on, despite its close ties to the Republican Party.
Right, that shift we talked about.
He believed 20th century capitalists often reaped unjust economic rewards without taking the same risks as earlier entrepreneurs. He feared that without some redistribution of wealth, the country risked radicalism, maybe even revolution. So he sought a new economic model with a larger regulatory role for the federal government.
Moving towards more government intervention over time.
In foreign policy, Henry Kissinger notes, Roosevelt was the first president to really assert the U.S. duty to make its power felt globally, rejected that passive city on a hill model.
Right, active engagement.
A social Darwinist, applying Darwinian ideas of struggle to societies and nations. He saw the international world as inherently violent. He rejected the effectiveness of international law, disarmament proposals, favored spheres of influence, harbored a deep distrust of Germany and Russia, believed the U.S. had to act decisively as the policeman of the region in the Western Hemisphere.
That social Darwinist label is key to understanding his worldview, I think.
It seems so.
Which brings us back to that really important point. How do we reconcile all these seeming contradictions in his character?
Yeah.
He's the ardent conservationist and the big game hunter, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and the advocate for the realism of war, the trust buster who initially worked within the system of big business. This complexity, well, is precisely what makes him such a compelling and enduring figure in American history. It forces us, you know, to consider the multifaceted nature of leadership, of human ambition. He wasn't a simple man with simple beliefs, was he?
He certainly wasn't, and that complexity is why we're still discussing him today. Theodore Roosevelt's impact on America is just immense, undeniable. He's credited with being the architect of the modern presidency, placing the bully pulpit at the center of national conversation, emphasizing character, fundamentally reshaping the office itself.
Transformed the presidency.
Consistently ranked among the top five presidents in U.S. history, a testament to his transformative leadership. His image is literally etched into American memory, standing proudly alongside Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln on Mount Rushmore.
An iconic image.
His famous ideology, speak softly and carry a big stick. It remains widely quoted, understood, influences political talk even today. A more whimsical but equally enduring part of his legacy, the teddy bear.
Ah, the teddy bear.
Named after him following that 1902 Mississippi hunting incident where he famously refused to shoot a bear cub someone had tied up for him.
A moment of mercy immortalized.
In a posthumous recognition of his military valor, Roosevelt was awarded the Medal of Honor in 2001 for his gallantry at San Juan Hill. Makes him the only president to receive it, though the process itself wasn't without some controversy.
Right, that took a long time.
Many places and things bear his name. Two U.S. Navy ships, 5 U.S. postage stamps, Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, even asteroid 1886-93 Roosevelt.
His name is everywhere.
He's also a recurring figure in popular culture, portrayed in films like The Wind and the Lion, Rough Riders, TV series like Night at the Museum, where Robin Williams brought a wax mannequin of him to life, even as a leader in video games like Civilization 6.
Still capturing the popular imagination.
However, his legacy isn't without debate. That equestrian statue of Roosevelt, showing him with a Native American and an African American figure positioned below him, it stood in front of New York's American Museum of Natural History for 80 years before it was removed in 2022 due to its hierarchical composition, reflects ongoing discussions about historical representation.
Yeah, a very visible example of reevaluating the past.
Importantly, Roosevelt was also one of the first presidents whose voice was actually recorded for posterity. Including a powerful 1912 speech defending the Progressive Party, allows us to actually hear the voice of this, well, this titan of history.
That statue removal is a really poignant example, isn't it, of how his legacy continues to be debated, reevaluated by new generations. It shows the lasting impact of his multifaceted, sometimes contradictory persona on American history and culture. It prompts people to critically engage with the complexities of his actions, his beliefs. He remains a powerful, if sometimes challenging, touchstone for understanding American identity and how we grapple with historical figures. Hashtag tag outro.
So we've journeyed through the incredible life of Theodore Roosevelt. From that sickly child who found strength through sheer force of will to a relentless reformer, a war hero, a transformative president who reshaped America both at home and abroad, and finally an explorer whose post-presidency was as eventful, as perilous as many full careers.
Quite a ride.
His legacy is just undeniable, marked by his groundbreaking conservation efforts, his trust-busting zeal, his placement of America firmly on the world stage, and that unique defining philosophy he championed. A strenuous life.
Indeed. And as we wrap up, maybe consider this provocative thought. Roosevelt once said, "I wish to do everything in my power to make the Republican Party the party of sane, constructive radicalism, just as it was under Lincoln."
Mm.
This raises an important question for us today, doesn't it? In a world grappling with information overload, complex global challenges, deep societal divisions, what might Theodore Roosevelt, with his intense moralism, his physical vigor, his pragmatic approach to reform, what might he advise you about engaging with the strenuous life of citizenship today? How would he urge you to actively participate, to question, and to strive for what you believe is right in a world that often feels, well, overwhelming? It's a question worth mulling over.